Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land.
Throws across his body, and he got it! We're going to wave McCann around third. Throw from the outfield is up the line, inside the park, home run! Deep, gone! Whoa! Up and he makes a catch up against the wall, and he's gonna watch it fly. Strike three called. He got him on strikes.
Welcome to The Voice of the Turtle, a podcast feature of the Bless You Boys website. That's SB Nation's Detroit Tigers blog. You can find us on the web at www.blessyouboys.com. Find us on Twitter at Bless You Boys, and also on Facebook at facebook.com/byb.tigers. I'm your host, Hook Slide, along with my partner, Rob Rojacki, a blossoming expert in daily fantasy sports. Rob, did you win any money on Alfredo Simon's craptastic performance today?
I did not. I picked the wrong Royals first baseman to put in my lineup, but we'll see. Maybe I'll be back at it tomorrow night.
Yeah, it's one of the nice things that you can maybe take away from a bad Tigers performance as we're recording this on Sunday evening on September the 20th, and the Tigers just lost, 10-3 was the final score. So Alfredo Simon, yes.
I think that they lost 10-3. I don't know. I started watching YouTube clips of gangster movies in the eighth inning.
I would love to know the thought process that led you to YouTube gangster film clips.
They showed Al Avila on the telecast.
I knew it. I freaking knew it. That's awesome. So yeah, so fantasy sports, money, how to enjoy the Tigers in a completely different way. We'll talk a little bit maybe about that later on in the podcast. And I am sure that everyone is incredibly eager to kick off the work week by listening to two guys talk about playing out the string baseball. So let's dig in, take a few practice swings, adjust the batting gloves, spit, and then get down to business. We'll talk about ruining the chances of playoff teams, Brad Ausmus's inability to ever make a good decision, ever, those pesky boo birds at Comerica Park, unlikely bullpen heroes, how to win at fantasy baseball, take some listener questions, and we might even rag on the Lions. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. But first, we got to have some fun rounding the bases and answer the question, Miggy, are you okay? After the break.
6'210" righty delivers as a fly ball left field. This one's deep. This one's got a chance, and this ball is gone. A home run. Ian Kinsler delivers the walk-off. Number 6 for Ian. He rounds third. Heads into the mop scene at home, and the Tigers take the series from AC. A walk-off home run from Kinsler. 8-6.
All right, let's get into our Rounding the Bases segment. Miggy, are you okay? Are you okay, Miggy? Miggy? Miggy, are you okay? You get that, Rob?
I got it.
All right.
I hope everyone else will, but we'll see.
I busted out Vanilla Ice like two podcasts ago, and I think that went over like a lead balloon, so just checking.
Yeah. I just can't sing as high as Michael Jackson. That's a problem.
That's probably a good thing. Oh, goodness. So the Tigers are actually winning. I mean, a little bit. We're into September now, 20 days into September, and they've actually managed to post a 9-9 record, which it's a good thing, I guess. Have we lowered the bar a little bit?
I think we've lowered the bar a lot. Yeah. It's sad that 9-9 in September is a good thing.
Yeah.
And the worst part of it is that they're being outscored 113-74. This month, so it's kind of a fluky 9-9 at that. They're actually winning one run games and getting blown out, which is like the exact opposite of what they used to do. It's weird.
That's just got the makings of championship team written all over it, right?
Absolutely. If they go 13-1 the rest of the way, they could still finish above 500.
Well, there's something to shoot for, right? This is funny to me because 9-9 that equates to a 500 record. I'm good at math like that. And I think one of the most sobering statistics that I came across a few months back even was the fact that after their super hot start in 2014 when they went 27-12, starting on like May the 18th and all the way through through the end of that year, including the playoffs, getting swept in the playoffs, they finished with a 500 record and continued that pattern kind of all throughout the rest of this year. Now we're at a point where they're not even really playing 500. It's a struggle to get back to that. But it's a little surprising to me to, I guess, notice that that's been the case for well over a year now.
It really is. And with the players they have in this roster, it's still kind of puzzling as to why they're so bad. I mean, you have Miguel Cabrera, you have JD Martinez. In 2014, you had a healthy Victor Martinez, and maybe even a little bit now. You've got a couple up-and-coming players, but, you know, last year the bullpen was so bad, and this year the entire pitching staff has just been so bad that it's counteracted all of those, you know, great players you have and just turned it into kind of a mess.
And yet, in spite of all of that, we're looking at the fact that they have just won three out of their past four series. They lost the series to Cleveland, but they won the series against the Tampa Bay Rays. They won the series against the Twins. And then just as of today, well, I mean, technically as of yesterday, taking two of three from Kansas City, there's still some winning mojo in this team.
It appears that way. And, you know, I'm still trying to kind of put my finger on exactly what it is. They've won a few close games. I know they won a couple one-run games against Tampa, a couple one-run games against one one-run game against the Twins, and then another one against Kansas City. So, you know, you get a few of these almost kind of fluky games that they're winning, you know, whether it's the bullpen actually locking down at certain moments, or, you know, the offense coming through finally with, you know, runners in scoring position. It's been a kind of a wild ride this month, but hey, you know, I'll take an extra win or two when we can get it.
Sure. I mean, it feels to me like it's really been kind of the better part of the offense that's making that happen, especially in these last two games with Kansas City, not counting today's loss, but they walked it off twice. And so you kind of go, well, the offense is somehow keeping up with that wreck of a rotation and bullpen. They're making things happen. Can we just talk a little bit about what happened last night? Because that was absolutely insane with Ian Kinsler scoring the walk-off win twice. I mean, of course it was reversed. The call was changed, you know, in the ninth inning when he scored from third on a sac fly, and they called him safe at first and then reviewed and then called him out. So we had to do it all over again. And how crazy was it that it was Ian Kinsler who then hit the walk-off home run a few innings later? Weirdest game you've ever seen?
Probably not the weirdest game I've ever seen, but it was definitely one of the more exciting ones they played this season.
Yeah.
If you kind of took that game by itself, that almost feels like actual September baseball. Like this team is in a pennant race. This felt like one of those games against the Royals last year, such as, you know, you remember the one where Hernan Perez spotted that someone had left early from the third base, from third base on a sac fly.
Yep.
You know, it had that kind of feel to it. And I feel like the fans at Comerica Park were very into it as well. So it was really kind of an exciting game to watch, but yeah, just kind of a wild finish there. I'm still not sure on the whole replay thing. I don't necessarily want to say that he was safe or out. It just seems like we've seen calls not get overturned for more evidence than what we saw there.
Yeah, I mean, just my personal opinion, he looked out, but that's, I mean, it's neither here nor there. I think for me, once the challenge was issued, kind of right in the middle of the whole, you know, mob scene and celebration on the field, once they issued the challenge and it was going to be down to a call to New York to decide whether or not it was indeed a walk-off, I kind of wanted it to not be a walk-off at that point, because that ruins the whole excitement at that point. You know, like, we're waiting for the call from New York to decide whether or not we can finally finish the celebration. I kind of wanted them to be out so they could win it the right way.
Yeah, it is kind of a little bit of a letdown almost when you have a walk-off win that it has to go to review and you have to wait around 2 to 3 minutes. You know, I thought they handled that one fairly quickly compared to some of the other ones we've seen, which was nice. But at the same time, you know, it was nice to see them walk it off, quote unquote, the right way with Kinsler hitting the home run to end it.
Yeah, and by the right way, I mean in such a way that the champagne doesn't go flat because you popped it in the ninth inning and then you had to wait two more innings. So not really happy about the way that panned out. But it was a cool home run, you know. Like you said, there was just maybe a few seconds finally of, you know, exciting baseball, September baseball. You mentioned, oh goodness, I think it was Salvador Perez who tagged up on that last year, I'm talking about, when Hernan Perez noticed that he left early from third base. I was thinking, too, it reminded me of Joe Nathan picking off Gerard Dyson at second base in one of those other Kansas City series last year that was like, oh man, there's so much excitement, so much electricity. You know, it's a nice little glimpse of the way things probably will be again soon.
Yeah, you'd like to think so. With those, you know, two walk-offs in a row, really, against Kansas City, it does kind of bring back those memories of last year when they played some really good games against Kansas City down the stretch. That was really kind of a fun pennant race. And, you know, now that we look, you know, at the time then, we were kind of nervous wrecks and we didn't want to blow this lead. And now we just kind of wish we had that again. So,
There's two things I want to talk about from that game, I guess. From last night's game, anyway, the one thing that I laughed about, it was in the ninth inning when Miguel Cabrera was allegedly hit by a pitch, and then Ned Yost decided to challenge that on the replay, and they upheld the call, and he was, yes, indeed, hit by a pitch and sent to first base. There were so many people reacting on Twitter, like, why would you, why would you want to...
Well, I think what Ned Yost was trying to do is challenge whether Miguel Cabrera was actually hit by the pitch.
Right, right. So if that call had been overturned, you've got Miggy back in the batter's box. I guess is the point that I was trying to make.
Yes.
And so why on earth would you do that as a manager? Why wouldn't you say, let him take the hit by pitch? I'd rather have Miguel Cabrera standing on first base than to go pitch to the guy, especially when his numbers against Hocheva are just, you know, astronomical. It's a Ned Yost moment, and it spawned this wonderful discussion on Twitter as to whether Ned Yost may actually be a worse manager than Brad Ausmus.
Well, in that situation, I think that it does kind of make sense. With Miggy hitting, I believe there was a runner on first at the time, so it would have sent that runner into scoring position for a couple of good hitters behind Miggy in J.D. Martinez and Victor Martinez. You mentioned Hocheva or Miguel Cabrera's numbers against Luke Hocheva, and he's hitting .450 with a .488 on-base percentage, which is phenomenal. But at the same time, a lot of those plate appearances came when Hocheva was a really crappy starter. And now that they moved into the bullpen, he's kind of had the whole Wade Davis effect, and he's really, really good now. He's 0-for-1 with the hit by pitch against Hocheva this year, and just 1-for-3 last year when Hocheva was coming out of the bullpen. So you notice that a lot of those kind of came early on when Hocheva wasn't really that good. So I think I don't necessarily want to say it's meaningless, but at the same time, it's kind of a different situation. And I get why Yost challenged them.
So you're saying Ausmus is worse than Yost?
I mean, I've said that multiple times before.
Just to validate, then, I'm not really sure how I feel. It's just funny to watch these two guys try to outmanage each other. It's like watching a Three Stooges movie without, you know, one of the Stooges, I guess.
Well, there was another Yost moment in today's game.
Yes,
I believe it was in the second inning when one of their players reached against Simon to lead off the second, and you know they were tagging the ball all over the park in the first inning. I actually looked up at one point in the first inning and I was like, how in the world do they have two outs? It was just line drives left and right. So anyway, back to the second inning with a runner on first, Yost decides to bunt against a guy who can't get the ball down in the strike zone and is just getting tattooed all over the place. I don't remember if it worked out for him or not, but at the same time I was like, dude, come on.
I would love to see, just for the pure chaos theory, I would love to see someday a Brad Ausmus managed team and a Ned Yost managed team play off, you know, in the World Series, face off in the World Series, just to enjoy the train wreck that would have to be. Especially if either of those guys had not so great bullpens to work with in the playoffs. But
those we would never get beyond game one because the games would never end.
The endless changing of pitchers and just, well, you never know. With the endless giving away your free outs via the bunt, you know, those things, two things might offset each other. You might zoom through some of those innings.
I feel like Ausmus's teams would lose because they ran into too many outs on the bases.
I don't know, man. Did you see what happened today with Kansas City? There were like at least two, maybe three pickoffs / well,
and,
bad
decisions. Alfredo Simon just tried to throw a ball into the back of Lorenzo Cain at one point, too.
It worked out.
It did. It also led to me spending three innings trying to figure out how to get that vine set to the Benny Hill theme.
Yakety Sax.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Just a comedy of errors today. It was, your 2015 Tigers and maybe a glimpse of what the Royals will someday collapse back into. I don't know. Just really weird to see them making so many outs on the bases, though. That's not typically Kansas City's thing. They're usually much better at the running game, but man, they were struggling to stay on base today, to the point where I think at one point we said they're like, I don't know, of the 9 outs that Simon had recorded, like 3 of them had come on the base paths. Oh my goodness. At this point, the strategy should be go ahead and intentionally walk the guy and then try and pick him off. You'll have a better rate of success, and you give up fewer home runs that way. Oh, my goodness. But going back to that game last night, and we talked about Miguel Cabrera and the hit-by-pitch and so forth. On the subject of Miguel Cabrera, a guy's in a little bit of a slump right now. And I know you posted something on the site kind of breaking down his swing analysis and how it seems to have changed a little bit. We could talk a little bit about that, but I also want to know, just in the last couple of games, are you seeing any kind of return to form in terms of that swing for Cabrera?
Yeah, going back a little bit, from what I saw in his swing earlier in the month, it seemed like Cabrera was kind of moving his back foot a little bit when he was swinging, almost kind of taking a little bit of a backward step. It's something that I'm kind of familiar with. I used to do it a lot as a player, and unlike Miguel Cabrera, I never really figured out how to change it. But with him, it really leads to kind of a loss of power. And even though, he's been able to compensate for that at times and still spray the ball all over the park, he did this a lot in 2012 and 2013 when he was kind of banged up a bit. But at the same time, it still kind of leads to a less effective Miguel Cabrera. And in this case, he was not hitting well. I believe he was hitting under 200 in the month of September at the time. Going back to the last couple games, I have seen a little bit of an improvement from him. He had a couple of multi-hit games in the first two games of the Royals series after he got most of the game off in the series finale against the Twins. So I don't know if it was a rest thing for him or what. And I believe he went 1-for-4 or 1-for-5 today. So, several hits in the last few games for him. So it seems like he's getting back on track a bit. But at the same time, the power is not really there. We haven't seen a Cabrera home run since late August against the Angels. And he only has a couple of doubles in that time as well.
Yeah, he needs to get some of that power back, because God knows this is the only reason we're watching the games anymore, is to watch Miggy be Miggy and destroy baseballs and send them, out of the stadium. Are you ready to back off your prediction that Cabrera wins the batting title, or is that still in play for you?
I think it's still in play. He's still hitting almost 340 at this point, 338 after today's game, in fact. And he's still got a pretty healthy lead against Xander Bogaerts, and I believe Michael Brantley is the other guy chasing him right now. I haven't taken a look at what their stats are exactly, but I still think it's a pretty big lead. He's probably got a good 20-point lead on either one of those guys right now, and I think that'll be really tough to make up in just 2 weeks.
Okay. All right. I'll buy it. I mean, I, not that I ever doubted it, really. I mean, there was a little period of there where he was through that slump, and you start to think, well, it's possible if he continues to slump through the rest of the season that he might lose a grip on that batting title. But, Miguel Cabrera is like the one guy that you don't worry about that with. That, if he goes into a bit of a slump, you just wait. That's it,
And with him, the only real question is whether he's hurt or not.
Right.
Like I said before, he was doing kind of these similar things with his swing when he was hurt over the last couple of years. He had insisted to reporters that he's healthy. And it seems like, maybe he just did need kind of that day off against Minnesota. With the off day gave him almost 2 full days off. And it seems like he's kind of back into the swing of things, no pun intended, this weekend. So hopefully we'll get a little bit of a healthier Miggy down the stretch. Although if Dave Clark decides to send him home on awful plays at the plate again, it may not last for long.
We will talk about that in the next segment, because we got a lot of words to say about Miguel Cabrera trying to run like he's Jerod Dyson, and he's just not at all. But speaking of guys that are hurt, and I kind of feel like Miguel Cabrera will always tell you that, no, I'm healthy, I'm good. I mean, the guy could like have his arm literally off and a stump bleeding, and he would still be like, no, I'm fine. It's not a big deal. But in the category of guys who do get hurt and do tell you that they're hurt and then end up going on the disabled list all the time, Aníbal Sánchez, we found out this week, is being shut down for the season with yet another shoulder injury. Catherine Slonskis, Slonksness, I can do this. Really, I can. Sorry, Catherine. put a post up on the site kind of detailing the injury history with Aníbal Sánchez, and that right shoulder that just keeps creeping up as a problem. So much so that I want to say the number she quoted was in the last 3.5 years of his contract with Detroit, he's only played 2.5. So he's lost almost a year's worth of time just due to the injury. This, to me, Rob, is a problem because it doesn't seem like it's going away. It's a recurring thing, whether it's, you know, the trying to think of all the different things that he had. It was shoulder tightness, and then he had surgery somewhere in there, and then there was a strained pectoral, and then it was upper back tightness, and now it sounds like maybe rotator cuff. As far as I know, and I'm not a medical expert, but generally when guys get older, they don't tend to bounce back faster from these things. They tend to fall apart faster. What are we looking at going into 2016? Is this something that the Tigers need to kind of say, hey, better have a plan B and a really good plan B, and not count on Sánchez to be one of two pillars, Justin Verlander being the other one, as the cornerstone of your rotation for that year?
It really is kind of a mystery with him. With the history of shoulder injuries, it's tough to rely on a guy for 200 plus innings going forward. Sánchez has never pitched 200 innings in a season, and it's been a couple years since he's even hit the 190 mark. He pitched 182 back in 2013 when he won the AL ERA title. But over the last couple of years, he's missed a fair amount of time on the disabled list. And this year, it seemed like he was kind of battling the shoulder thing all year long. The nice thing is that with him being shut down for the year and not needing surgery, he can kind of spend the offseason getting healthy, getting right, and coming back in spring training to kind of get on the right track. If you remember back in 2014, he missed part of spring training and part of the early part of the year, and I think that might have led to some of the shoulder issues he had down the line, not being able to prepare the right way for the season. Like we've seen with other guys, with Justin Verlander and whatnot, when they're able to finally get healthy, they're pitching a little bit better and they're looking a little bit stronger. It'll be tough to see how exactly that happens with Sánchez. It seems like he's just kind of one of those guys that's a little bit injury prone. I'm not really sure why. It seems like he has a pretty clean delivery, but, you know, at the same time, with all the shoulder injuries he's had in the past, it's tough to say exactly how healthy he's going to be going forward. At the same time with that, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you're probably about to address the very thing I was going to bring up, so just go right ahead.
Well, with what the Tigers should do going forward with that, it's almost like you don't necessarily want to pretend like he's not there this offseason, but I think you need to downgrade your expectations for him. You can't expect to get a guy who's going to go out and throw 200 innings with a ERA under 3.5. He may very well give you that ERA under 3.5. He's done that over the last couple years prior to this year, and has really been very, you know, kind of a pillar of this rotation. But maybe you expect that for 120, 140 innings, if that. I don't know how much those home run troubles we've seen from him this year are going to carry forward, especially if he does get healthy this offseason. So we may very well get the more effective pitcher that we had, you know, like the guy from 2014 who had 3.43 ERA. You know, that is fine going forward as long as they kind of plan for that and, you know, maybe go out and get another top-end starting pitcher to pair with Verlander at the top of the rotation and bank on Sánchez being more of a number three or four type.
Yeah, or maybe more like a 2.5, because, if, you know, if I'm hearing what you're saying, right, if you can only count on the guy for 140-so innings, then you got to have a backup plan. You got to be prepared for the possibility that maybe his arm just falls right off, you know, midway through the season, and suddenly you got to fill up two and a half months worth of starts. I guess the nice thing in that situation, if it comes to that, is that you do have a Matt Boyd, possibly, that can step in, assuming that he's not part of the starting rotation in 2016. I don't think he would be, but he'd be a nice backup spot starter. You would have, you know, some options, I guess, and maybe Michael Fulmer. We don't know a whole lot about what he would be like at the major league level, but, you know, assuming that Sánchez is okay through, let's say, the All-Star break next year, that might give us some time to see what Michael Fulmer can do at the AAA level, and maybe there's someone else that you can bring in for a spot. So I'm just saying I'm happier with a possible Fulmer / Boyd / maybe Lobstein option than having to go back to, like, Buck Farmer filling in spot starts.
I would be happier with that, too, and I think that the Tigers need to hedge their bets with that. Not necessarily in keeping those guys down or whatnot, but maybe you go out and get your kind of frontline starter, Jordan Zimmerman type or someone like that. And then you get more of a, I don't know if I want to say buy low candidate, but someone who's not going to cost as much and can eat some innings for you at the back of the rotation. That doesn't necessarily mean an Alfredo Simon, someone who's going nowhere, and I think we'll talk about him a little bit more later. But, you know, someone kind of like Chris Medlin, who we saw today, a pitcher who, you know, maybe he was injured at some point or just kind of is coming off of a bad year. And if you can get someone like that at a little bit of a cheaper price that can also eat some innings for you, then maybe you can kind of control your guys down in the minor leagues so that you're not running into the problems we are seeing with some other teams when their younger pitchers are getting into September and October and they're running into innings limits.
Yeah, I think the Tigers do have some options there, and you can kind of look back to like maybe the 2013 situation when you've got a guy like Drew Smyly who's sort of stretched out and maybe can, he's, you know, kind of a long-term long relief guy. Not saying that Drew Smyly should have been used that way, but that's just the way it was. But you could have a guy like maybe an Alex Wilson who's stretched out and can do multiple innings. Some of that potentially you can maybe stretch out as a starter by mid-season just in case.
Yeah, and Wilson really is kind of a good point there. I didn't really think about him. The Tigers had kind of maybe mentioned that they might think about Wilson as a starter at some point. I thought I remembered reading something about that over the last month or two. And it does make sense. You know, Wilson has been a very effective pitcher for them this season. He's got multiple pitches. He's shown the ability to get through the lineup a couple times going multiple innings. So, you know, it's worth mentioning there. He could be sort of a solid long reliever or a relief ace if you're willing to be a little bit more progressive with it and use him for multiple innings at a time. And then if they need him at some point, they could bump him up to the rotation.
Would love to see them use him as a relief ace in longer outings, but I'm pessimistic. I don't think that's ever going to happen. They're going to have to find a quote-unquote closer and a ninth-inning specialist, and that's probably the route that they'll go. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they want to make of Alex Wilson going into next year. So, all right, I think that's enough for rounding the bases. We have rounded them enough. I'm getting tired. Let's go into the next segment and warming in the pen, and you gotta stop waving this guy around third. We'll talk about that next.
Here's the 2-2. Swing the fly ball right field. Deep and down the line and gone! Victor Martinez with a two-run shot. Tigers back on top here in the seventh. They lead it 7-6.
All right, we are into our warming in the pen segment when we sort of look forward to what the next week holds. It's been a long time since we've really looked forward to anything with the Tigers, and it's nice to know that there's only a couple more weeks of this, and still trying to find reasons to watch. We're going to talk a little bit about that, but the teaser on this segment is you've got to stop waving this guy around third base, and we are talking about, of course, Miguel Cabrera. Please, please stop sending him on plays to the plate. It's like he's become he's filling in the role that Prince Fielder used to fill back in the old days.
Well, I'd like to think Miguel Cabrera could slide a little bit better than Prince Fielder ever did. Although those did make for some pretty hilarious posts.
A wiping out truck on the snow could slide better than we've seen Prince Fielder.
He was kind of snowplow like, if you think about it.
Yeah, they blow a tire and just flip. Yeah, bad times. But why do they keep doing this? I mean, Dave Clark was supposed to be, you know, a little bit, well, before I even go down that path, I didn't see the video. Is it possible Dave Clark threw up the stop sign and Miggy said, screw you, I'm going, like he is somewhat known to do?
No, I watched it and I believe that Dave Clark did wave him home. And, you know, if this were more of a pennant race, if the Tigers were playing for something, I may have been a little bit more lenient on it. It wasn't that egregious. It was definitely not his worst send, Dave Clark's worst send that we've seen this season. But at the same time, you know, with the Tigers so far back and not really playing for anything, you got to keep Miguel Cabrera healthy. You don't want, you know, a bad situation, a Buster Posey-like situation where he breaks a leg or does something else to that calf that he's already strained this year. And then has a setback going into the offseason. You got to keep him as healthy as you can.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that it kind of comes down to that. I know he's you know, not getting any younger, and it's not necessarily a case of saying, oh, decline, you know, this is happening, he's hitting the downward trend. But at the same time, you know, he does have some issues. He had the surgery, he had, you know, the groin strain, he's got the strained calf and so forth. He's a kind of a big guy, you know. I don't know that you ever want to put him in that situation where he's got to be, you know, chugging along, especially with the way that he plays at the plate can end up in collisions and weird slides and things happening. It's you really just want him to be, I don't know, Rob, are we looking at a situation where in a couple of years he's going to end up just sort of being the DH, where that's the only thing you got to do is just go up there and hit?
He may very well be the DH at some point, but at the same time, you still have Victor Martinez around for 3 more years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe they will start to split a little bit more time, especially if Victor can stay healthier next season. But at the same time, he's definitely heading down that route.
Well, I think we can agree on this. Miguel Cabrera needs to be wrapped in bubble wrap in the offseason. Just wrap him up, stick him in the closet, and don't break him back out until spring training.
Can we wrap him in big poofy tires like the Michelin Man?
Ooh, that creates some kind of uncomfortable mental imagery. So I'm going to go ahead and move on from that, because
bubble wrap makes a nice popping sound too.
That's true. Here you go. Wrap him up in yards and yards of this stuff and say, now pop your way out. When you get out, we'll go play spring training. It'll be fun. Pop, pop, pop. Whew, getting weird, getting punchy. It's Sunday. It's the end of the weekend, and I need to like pick up some steam to head up into the work week. So I don't. Coming up this week, that's the whole point of this Warming in the Pen segment. We've still got a few more series to finish. We're going to be talking too a little bit about what to look for. In fact, let's just go there. What are we left looking for in these games? There's specific players I think we still want to keep an eye on. We're talking about Miguel Cabrera, you know, as being the guy to watch in the batting race. JD Martinez obviously is still a lot of fun to watch. Not only are there reasons to keep watching, Rob, as I mentioned, I'm actually going to the ballpark on Wednesday. So not only am I watching, I'm paying money to like drive and sit in a seat and watch up close and personal, and Verlander on the mound. How awesome is that?
You lucked into that one too. You've been talking about this for weeks.
I did. I totally lucked into it. And I read the schedule wrong, because I counted just by game to see where the rotation would fall on that day. And I went, oh, I'm going to miss Verlander by like one day. And it turns out it's because two of those games are actually on the same day. It's tomorrow's doubleheader. So I miscounted. And it turns out Verlander is pitching on Wednesday. And I've got tickets like in the on deck circle. So yay me. This might save the season for me.
Very nice.
So what are we looking for in these games, other than, you know, going to the ballpark and drinking sour apple moonshine, which is apparently a thing I found out that they actually do serve at Comerica Park, and I'm going to drink so much of that when I get there. And you know, but outside of the ballpark experience, what's some of the things that we're still looking for?
Well, you mentioned Miguel Cabrera and JD Martinez. I'm going to be watching Victor Martinez a little bit more going down the stretch. He's actually looked pretty good in the last few games. His swing is looking a lot better. He's hitting the ball a lot harder, although a lot of the times it is kind of going straight to fielders. And he's not really hitting for much power yet, but I think that will come. But it really is encouraging to see him take some better swings, especially from the left side of the plate, where he struggled for so much of this year. And I don't know if it necessarily has taken his knee this long to get healthy, but it is kind of that situation where, you know, he missed spring training and then went through this whole ordeal with a knee throughout the first half of the year. And so it was almost like July and August served as his spring training, if you will.
Yeah.
And he's just finally rounding into form now. So it will be interesting to see kind of how he comes back next year. Another guy that I'm actually really excited to watch going down the stretch now is Dixon Machado. Oh, he had the walk-off hit on Friday after a really good at-bat, where he kind of waited out and took a couple close pitches and then, you know, found a pitch to hit when Holland hung a curveball or something over the plate and hit it down the line. But he has also looked really good and really smooth in the field. Mm-hmm. You know, we've lost Jose Iglesias for a while, but it's like we've kind of got the same guy already in the field, and it's great to watch.
Oh, he is so trade bait. He is so trade bait in 2016. I mean, am I wrong?
I wouldn't say. I think that, let me back up here. I think that one of him or Jose Iglesias will be traded.
Did you just suggest that they would trade Iglesias?
I wouldn't be that shocked if they did, especially with the season that Iglesias had. you know, let me ask you this. Do you think Jose Iglesias is going to hit 300 again next year?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, close to it. He's not going to drop off to like 220. I mean, I could see him putting up like a respectable 288 or a 293 or something. But yeah, I mean, close enough. Yeah.
See, I saw a stat that he's hitting under 250 over the last couple months. So, you know, if the Tigers can find someone to really overpay for Iglesias, maybe you take that deal and make Machado the starter. I don't like the idea of it, depending on what the return would be, but I'm just saying it's possible.
Yeah, and we're done here. I don't even want to talk to you anymore. You just completely ruined the rest of my season with that. Because now I'm going to go into the offseason having that ringing in my head, and I'm going to be scared every time there's an announcement that the Tigers are about ready to, you know, announce the next trade that they made. Oh, I hope they don't get rid of Iglesias. He is fun to watch. See, I'm already talking about him in the past tense. Look what you've done. This is bad. This is bad. This is really bad.
And our seventh episode is our final episode.
And that's it. We made it to seven, got the seven episode itch, and screw you guys. I'm going home. Now, let me ask you this, because I was just looking at the updated stats, and what is it, 14 games left, I think, now, because they still haven't scheduled the Cleveland one, or if they have, Baseball Reference hasn't picked up on it yet. I think it's 13, 14 games left. And JD Martinez is sitting at 37 home runs. Do you still think he's going to get over that two or over the 40 home run mark?
I do. The Tigers have six games to close out the season at very hitter-friendly ballparks, and I think it's going to come down to that final series in Chicago, but I still think he's going to do it. I was encouraged that he hit a home run this last week to make sure that I wasn't a total jinx, but I still think I may kind of downgrade my number to 40 instead of 42, like I said last time, mm-hmm. but I still think he's going to do it.
I'm sticking with 39. He's going to get to 39 just because it's been that kind of a year. It's been crazy. Oh, my goodness. When we talk about the fact that the Tigers are obviously out of the playoff race in any meaningful way, and they're mathematically eliminated from taking the division title, I think probably at this point they're out of the wild card race, too. I don't know. That's math. That's more math than I really want to do in preparation for this show. But the question kind of comes up, as you've mentioned on the site, I think, before, with the series coming up here on Friday, so this next weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, against the Minnesota Twins, they do have an opportunity to play the spoiler, just to be the little, you know, the brats, the fly in the ointment, so to speak. So, question I guess we have to kind of knock around is, would we rather see the Tigers win those games and knock the Twins out of the playoffs and get sweet, sweet, sweet revenge, just because we hate the Twins? Or would you rather have them lose those games, not ruin the Twins' chances, and still keep that top 10 protected pick?
A lot would need to happen between now and then. As of right now, the Twins are still 2.5 games out of the wild card, so it would take kind of a big jump for them to get into that position. But if the Tigers could take a couple games from them in that series, I would probably take that over the protected pick. The fan in me really kind of wants Minnesota to just kind of go away and die. But and you know, even though that top 10 protected pick is very important, I would really just kind of like us to, you know, get back at Minnesota for a couple of those years where they took us down a peg in the final weeks of the season.
It kind of seems like if that's your approach, though, then it's kind of a win-win scenario, right? I mean, if they don't knock Minnesota out of the playoffs, then at least you can say, hey, protect the pick. And if they do happen to knock Minnesota out, hey, they knocked Minnesota out. Minnesota, what? I mean, what? It's strange to me that they're still doing what they're doing. They won again today. Beat the Los Angeles Angels 8-1. Torii Hunter, of all people, hit a home run, so he's still apparently a viable product. They've got that new character, Sano. I mean, do they even have a shot at this, or is this just kind of that fluky, you know, end-of-season drive, and yeah, we knew this was not going to end that well?
I think they still have a shot at it. Their whole season has kind of been fluky with the whole negative run differential and all that. Mm-hmm. But they have a series coming up against Cleveland, the Indians again, and then the Royals to close out the season. And if the Royals have kind of shut things down in that last season of series of the year, we could see the Twins kind of sneak into things. We saw Cleveland do that just a couple years ago when they played a bunch of teams that were kind of out of contention in the final week or two of the season. And I believe they finished like 11-1 or something like that to sneak into the wild card game. So, you know, it's definitely possible, especially with teams like Houston and the Angels and Texas all beating each other up in that West Division, that, you know, if the Twins get hot at the right time, they could find their way in there.
Yeah, and like I said, if the Royals kind of wrap it up and end up just playing those last couple of games, you know, kind of like the Tigers did when they clinched it, and I think it was like 2013, and you didn't see a regular starter hit the field for more than, you know, 15 minutes, that could be an interesting final series for the Twins. But I'm not sure who I would take in a matchup between, you said they're playing the Indians in two separate series towards the end, and I'm not sure who I'd favor in that case. The Indians are not bad. I mean,
well, the Indians are still fighting for it too. As I'm looking at it right now, they're only four games out of the wild card after, you know, really kind of coming on strong over the last few weeks. The rotation is really rounding into form, and they're starting to, you know, score a few runs for their team. So with their schedule going down the stretch, they may be able to, you know, it's tough to say at this point with so little time left, but, you know, if they get hot at the right time, that could also happen too.
Well, like I said, either way it turns out, whether the Tigers spoil the Twins' chances, that would be awesome. And if they don't, and we still get to keep a top 10 pick, that's also awesome. Best of both worlds. I mean, maybe you get them both. Maybe you can still keep the pick and knock the Twins out. And then, you know, again, we maybe have salvaged the season in some small way.
It's definitely possible that that happens, because the Tigers are kind of directly competing with the White Sox for one of those protected picks, and they have six or seven games left against them going down the stretch. So, you know, if the Tigers tank the right way and lose a lot of these games, they might still be able to do it.
If they tank the right way. That is what we have come to, folks. That's the 2015 season, hoping the Tigers will tank the right way. I think we have our podcast episode title now, Tanking the Right Way. If only the Cardinals could help us kind of understand. Maybe we'll get Brian McCann on the horn here. He can show us how to tank the right way. Probably that'll wrap up our Warming in the Pen segment. We've looked forward to what's coming up. It's all winding down. That's a good thing. Very, very much looking forward to what happens in the off season, and looking forward to what happens in 2016. So we'll go ahead and wrap up this segment and get ready for the all-out brawl that we're about to have in the next segment. In High and Tight, we're going to talk about the art of booing when we get back from the break.
Bringing a fly ball center field. This one's deep, going back. Borges at the warning track, looking up, and it's gone! A home run!
Amazing.
How about it? First chance to hit 400, and Miguel Cabrera delivers in his first at-bat of the day.
And we are back with the High and Tight segment, when we like to look at the hot items in the news. And there is really only one big, super hot, flaming, hot, takey item that has dominated the news headlines for the Tigers for the last, I don't know, 3-4 days. Feels like a lot longer than that. Feels like the radio guys were talking about it even on Monday or something. So it's been going on for a while. The question is to boo or not to boo. And this goes back, Rob, to, well, Victor Martinez started it with some comments to, I think it was Chris McCoskey, talking about basically that, you know, he feels that the Tigers fan base has kind of taken for granted the fact that they went on a four consecutive year division run. They dominated. They made it to the playoffs 4 years in a row. And it's hard work to do that, says Victor. And he feels like the fans just don't really appreciate that. And Nick Castellanos piggybacked on that in an interview with, I think it was Matt Derry at 105.1, and basically said the same thing. Said, yeah, you know, you think it's, what the quote was, fans always say World Series, World Series, World Series, and they don't appreciate what it takes to get there. You have to win, you know, the division, then you have to win the championship series. There's a lot of hard work that goes into this, and, you know, basically the fans just don't appreciate it. Victor got himself into some trouble with this, I think, because of the language that he used. He said this is going to be, the fact that the Tigers are now in last place, and they're not even going to make an appearance in the postseason in October, he said, is going to be a lesson to everybody. And he included the players, he included the clubhouse, he included the management and the front office, and then he said, and also it's going to be a lesson for the fans. That that doesn't sit well, I don't think, with the fan base. When you use language like that, like they need to learn a lesson, he didn't say they need to, he just said that they will learn a lesson. I'm going to give Victor a little bit of wide leeway on that, because, you know, maybe the guy whose first language is not English, maybe he should get a little bit of a break when he doesn't get the idiom right. I think what he meant to say is it's going to be a wake-up call, which, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he's probably right about that.
He is, and I remember a couple years back, I would joke that the Tigers needed to have kind of one bad season in the middle of this great run just to kind of knock all of the bandwagon fans off of the wagon, so to speak. You know, with these comments he's making, I believe he made some comment about the ALDS game 3 last year, which was a little bit interesting. Right. But at the same time, you know, I kind of get both sides of the argument. I know that the fans are frustrated, and fans are very fickle in the first place. They're going to take things kind of at face value, and they're very much a "what have you done for me lately" type of crowd. Whereas, you know, I think the Tigers are a little bit frustrated at their performance as well, and they don't like hearing this booing, which I think for the most part has kind of been justified this year. You know, I mean, there have been certain instances where you could kind of debate it, but for the most part, I think the fans were patient for a lot of the season, and it's really kind of come to roost now that, you know, the September has come and they're out of the race and things just aren't getting better at all.
Yeah, and that's really kind of part two of the issue. And this is where I think both Victor and Nick kind of went off the rails just a little bit. I get what they're saying about, hey, it seems like the fans don't really appreciate the fact that we were dominant for 4 years in a row. And this is going to be a wake-up call, or to use Victor's words, this is going to be a lesson, you know, to say, well, now we're not even going to be in October baseball. So, yeah, what do you think about that? But they both players made reference to Game 3 of last year's ALDS, and the fact that during the pregame ceremonies, the opening ceremonies, and the player announcements, the fans were booing. And according to Nick, both Victor and I think David Price had some things to say about that last year, and some of the quote-unquote veteran players, he said, haven't forgotten that the fans booed during the opening player announcements. And this is where I think they both kind of missed it here, because those two issues are very much not related. The issue of, hey, the fans don't appreciate division titles, and as proof, they were booing us in Game 3. Booing in Game 3 was very specific. It was very context-specific. It came right on the heels of them blowing the first two games. Well, I mean, they certainly blew the second one. The first one, you know, they were losing in late innings, but it was still within reach. You still could have got some late innings offense and maybe come back in Game 1 until Jabba Chamberlain and Joaquin Soria did their thing, and that game got out of hand. And then in Game 2, they were winning until Jabba Chamberlain and Joaquin Soria, and I'll include in that Brad Ausmus, who decided to go back to those same two arms, and they blew that game. Now they come back to Comerica down 2-0, and it's really, really hard to snap off three wins in a row like that. The booing, as far as I recall, and I couldn't find any tape on it, but as far as I recall, they booed. And well, Nick actually mentioned this. Nick specifically said, yeah, the fans were booing Brad Ausmus. They were booing Jabba Chamberlain very heavily, and they were booing Joaquin Soria. Personally, I think that's totally justified, and I don't understand where they're coming from. The you know, Nick saying, hey, this is a playoff atmosphere. How is it that we're coming into our own home court in the playoffs and the fans are booing? Well, maybe because of what went down in the first two games.
I think that they're both kind of right in that instance. You know, Castellanos and Victor, you as players, I think they want to have the support of the fans there, and to get booed during pregame introductions, I think is a little bit frustrating for them. You know, had they blown the game at home the night before, I might have understood it a little bit more. But you know, I think that the fan base, kind of could have been a little bit better in that regard. But at the same time, you know, with you mentioning how specific the booing was, you know, it wasn't just booing the entire time. It wasn't booing the entire team. It was booing, you know, a few specific people. And I think that that makes a little bit more sense, especially with booing Brad Ausmus with some of the moves he made. I'm a little bit more lenient as far as booing players in instances like that. And I think that that has to do, like, if I were to choose to boo a player, I think it would be more effort-based than anything else. Hmm. You know, you get guys like that, and it's tough to be too angry about a player being put in position to fail by his manager, like Ausmus did with a couple of those guys. So it's tough for me to blame Chamberlain, to blame Soria in those instances. No, was it even Joaquin Soria? Did he even pitch in that instance, or was it?
Yeah, he pitched in both. Okay. Especially in Game 2, it was Jabba Chamberlain that came out and I think loaded the bases, and then Soria is the one that came in and gave up the hit to Delmon Young that cost him the game. But I mean, most of that's on Jabba. But yeah, Soria had his part in both of those games.
Okay. With that, it's tough for me to kind of condone it at the beginning of the game when, you know, your team is kind of backed against the wall, and I think that the players would like a little bit more support in that. you know, had Chubb been brought into the game later and been booed then, I think it would have made more sense. But it seemed like it was a little bit, I don't want to say over the line, but a little bit too much as far as doing it during the pregame warmups.
Yeah, I'm struggling to understand why that's a problem, I guess, because I like you said, I get it from both sides. I understand the player perspective of like, okay, we really need some positive energy from the hometown crowd. I felt bad for Nick Castellanos saying what he did. He said, you know, when we were in Baltimore, the atmosphere was so electric at Camden Yards. They were cheering on their team. And he said, I can't wait to get back home, you know, and have this be our fans cheering for us and to give us some of that, you know, same feeling. And then they come back and there's boos, you know, but on the other hand, you know, again, given what had happened and the fact that it was not really an isolated incident, Chamberlain coming out, the bullpen in general coming out and blowing a very important game had been happening kind of all year. What I've noticed with this fan base is, number one, they are a very hardcore fan base. People always talk about how Detroit's a baseball city and they will pack that stadium, you know, year in and year out, and they still are. It's meaningless baseball in September, and they're still putting 32 to 34,000 people in the stands. It's a dedicated crowd, but I've noticed that they have a threshold. They will get to a point where, you know, like last year, Joe Nathan was blowing games left and right, and after about maybe the fourth, fifth, sixth one, that's when they kind of let loose with the boos. Justin Verlander was struggling for a good portion of that year, and by the time they got to whatever number start that was for him in June, they just kind of hit that point, and then he got booed. They just tend to kind of go that way. I guess if I put myself in the fan position, though, Robin, maybe you disagree, but if it's me in that crowd in Game 3 of the ALDS, having just seen what we just saw and the frustration of, you know, and feeling like this is pretty much all but over, it's going to be really hard to snap off three wins in a row and not be eliminated. When it comes time in that moment and they announce, and number 44, Jabba Chamberlain, am I going to feel like cheering at that point? I'm struggling to enter into that one.
See, I kind of disagree with it, but at the same time, I guess it does make a little bit more sense in that context. It's just tough for me to really think that I would boo heavily at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe later on in the game, like I said, but in that moment, especially during pregame introductions, I think that's just kind of a, you know, not really the right place for it.
Right. Well, and speaking of Jabba Chamberlain, Catherine did another post for us just a couple days ago, did an interview with Jabba Chamberlain. Jeff Rieger from 97.1 also did an interview with him. I caught part of that in the pregame show, I think it was Friday night, talking about what he experienced with, you know, playing in Detroit and the boos and that kind of thing. And I've said the word boos so many times, I kind of want some liquor now. I'm just noticing it's like it's a subtle thing. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Jack Daniels. Anyway, Jabba talked about the experience of being booed by the fans, and he kind of went both routes with it. He said, yeah, I understand it, you know, and it's kind of okay. At the same time, I'm not cool with it. And he talked about somebody actually going to his house. Some fan showed up at his house to yell at him. That's, I mean, obviously that's over the top, but I guess It spawned some interesting discussion, I think, in the comments on the website, you know, and people kind of challenging the whole concept as a concept. Booing a player is just never acceptable, some people say. And I tend to take the other side of that and say, I'll go back to what Jabba Chamberlain said in the interview with Rieger. He said, hey, I don't get to show up at your office and throw staplers at you. This is the only job in the world where, you know, people get to boo at you. And I thought, well, yeah. Of course, because you're part of like the 0.003% of the population of this country that gets to play a sport for a living. You work in the entertainment industry, and that's all this is. I don't care what your level of fan allegiance is, and I know some people are very, very allegiant to the team because it's hometown and it's linked with dad and grandpa and grandma and the family and the whole thing. But guess what? It's still just sports entertainment, and as an entertainment industry, these players are putting on a performance. Cheering and booing have been part of that industry time immemorial. I mean, you have two sets of emotions. You can approve of what's happening and be excited. You express it by applauding and cheering and yelling. And if you're not happy with it, you express that by booing. I mean, to me, it's two sides of the same coin. You can't say you can do one and then not the other. I mean, call me crazy.
See, I agree with that. I think that there is a time and place for booing, and I don't think that it's, you know, I think that it's acceptable to do that at times. I kind of mentioned before that, like, you know, if a player is not putting forth enough effort, he absolutely deserves it. You know, there are other instances where it can be kind of part of the game. I remember before the season, I went to a preseason game where the Nationals were playing the Yankees here in D.C., you know, and A-Rod comes up to the plate and everyone in the park boos him. You know, it was kind of more of a cheeky fun thing at that point. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't think that there's, you know, no instance for it. You know, and with a player struggling, you mentioned Joe Nathan earlier, Jabba Chamberlain, when those guys are struggling during the season and letting up runs left and right and, you know, blowing saves in three or four consecutive appearances, I think that that situation is absolutely justified. I think there are just kind of certain instances, you know, and I think this happens with every fan base where every once in a while, I think it's a little bit over the top.
Yeah, it can be over the top. It can be a little bit quick on the trigger. I think the Tigers fans, like I said, are pretty good about having a higher threshold for that sort of thing. It just kind of strikes me as, you know, it's just part of the it's part of the job. You know, it's what you do. You're a performer, and you're going to get booed sometimes. You're going to get cheered. You know, it all depends on how you're performing. And I guess there needs to be some separation of booing as, you know, as an insult to the person, or booing as a commentary on the performance. And Jabba even talked, I don't know if he realized he was saying it, but he kind of hit on that when he said some guys will boo at you, but then later you talk to them, you're like, oh, hey, man, I was just kidding. You know, people are people are people. And I go, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think I've ever done it live, but I mean, I've certainly yelled things at my television when Phil Koch was doing bad things a couple of years ago. And then I met him in the ballpark, and he not only signed a baseball for my son, but when he saw that I was setting up my camera, you know, and trying to snap a picture of the moment, stopped. He stopped and said, oh, hang on. And then he spun around and grabbed my kid and pulled him close. I was like, okay, now get the picture. Really cool guy in person. I have nothing bad to say about Jabba Chamberlain, Phil Koch, Joe Nathan as people. But, you know, as performers, I think you got to be able to separate that and say, I'm not booing you as a human being. That's not what it's about. I'm just not happy with what you're putting out on the field right now. And as a paying customer, you know, until Comerica starts issuing partial ticket refunds for crappy performances, I have no other way to express that.
Absolutely. And it kind of goes back to some other things I've noticed. You know, if someone were to comment on the site or whatnot and say, you know, oh, this guy's an asshole or whatever, you know, I really kind of stop and think about that. I've worked with professional athletes as, you know, in my setting as a physical therapist before, and they're, you know, far different people from what you see on the field and things like that. And it kind of helped me to kind of separate the person and the player, so to speak. You know, you get these guys, you see them in the media, you see them out on the field, and then they can be totally different people behind closed doors. You know, a lot of the guys, I was pleasantly surprised with a lot of the people that I met. They were very nice. So it really kind of helps me take a look back at that. You know, you see a guy, you know, even if he's acting up on the out on the field, you know, a guy like Bryce Harper, who has gotten a lot of scrutiny for the way he acts on the field, you know, I really kind of try to separate that and think, you know, maybe he is, you know, a great guy off the field, things like that.
Well, I think at some point we need to get Phil Koch's brain to come on the show and give us the proper instruction on how to boo with respect, because he is the master of respectful booing. It's polite but devastating. You know, when the player comes to the plate and strikes out, and he will let loose with, you know, he will literally do this. I've been to games with him. He will sit there and yell things like, perhaps your approach to the plate could have been a little better. That was suboptimal performance. You're like, well, it's, you know, true, I guess. That's you know, it's not an insult. So, well, yeah, if you ever get a chance to go to a game with Phil Koch's brain, my God, that is some funny stuff. Let's extend the discussion just a little bit, not to beat the dead horse, but it ties into our next topic that one of the players who mentioned the booing issue was Justin Verlander, because it came to that when he was pulled from the game on Friday night game. He was pulled from the game in the ninth inning, and Brad Ausmus left the field to raining down boos upon him. And Justin actually apparently made some gestures to the crowd like, hey, knock it off. And he commented about it later and said, you know, I get the whole booing thing. And Justin's actually been very good about that. When he got booed in 2014, he said, yeah, I deserved it. I would have booed myself. In this instance, he said, it's not the right thing to do. Whether you feel, you know, however you feel about that, was Brad Ausmus right to pull him from the game?
Well, going back to kind of the booing aspect of it first, I know that some people were kind of trying to make it a story as far as, you know, there's a shot of Verlander kind of staring in Brad Ausmus's direction at one point. I don't know if he was actually looking at him or the field of play. It's tough to tell. And a lot of people were kind of trying to make it as Verlander was very angry with Ausmus. Mm-hmm. And this kind of comes on, it was actually kind of funny. It comes on the same night that Max Scherzer is yelling at his manager and telling him, I want the effing ball or whatever it was. but with that, you know, I saw a great camera angle on, I think it was on MLB Network the next day, where, you know, Verlander kind of hears the boos. This is as Ausmus is walking off, and he's like looking around at the crowd. He yells, you know, he says something like, are you effing kidding me? And you can read his lips pretty clearly in this instance. So it really was kind of very reactionary to what he was hearing. So I definitely buy like his comments on it. And he's really has been great about when he has been booed as a player, really kind of taking it in stride very well. You know, it's good to see that he's gotten back on track and he's getting far more cheers than boos at this point. You know, and as for the actual decision to take him out in that game, I get where Brad Ausmus is coming from. And I think Verlander's comments on the matter kind of sold it for me as well. You know, Verlander was at 115, 116 pitches, something like that at that point. You know, you get a guy at the plate at Salvador Perez who has absolutely killed Verlander in his career. I think he's hitting something like 480 in about 50 at bats against him, which is not that small of a sample size as far as a pitcher batter matchup goes. You know, Perez had already hit a couple pretty hard balls off of Verlander at one point in the game before. So going to him, you know, and if you do get a long at bat out of Perez, and this was Verlander's take on it, is that if Perez gives you a long at bat, you're looking at, you know, upwards of 125 pitches in the start. And I don't know if that's what you want Verlander to be doing at this point in the season, and kind of a lost season. So, you know, it didn't end up well. But I think with Ausmus, A, going to Alex Wilson, his best reliever, and B, taking out Verlander when he did, I think it was overall the right move, even though it didn't work out.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, as much as I would love to do the hot take thing here and just for the sake of argument and make the show a little more interesting, I really can't disagree with that. I mean, as I said to you guys in the chat room the other night, I'm like, yeah, you got to take any opinion that I have about Brad Ausmus with a huge, huge grain of salt, because I just think Ausmus sucks at everything that he ever has said or done. And I know that's a very jaded, slanted, kind of crazy perspective that colors everything. So yeah, my first reaction to him pulling Verlander was, that kind of thing. I wouldn't have a problem with him letting Verlander finish the game. I think with the two outs in the ninth, you know, the guy has earned that much. Let him finish it. Let it be his game to win or lose. But there are so many good arguments, like you just said and listed, for getting him the hell out of there and going. I was so pleased that in retrospect that Ausmus went to Alex Wilson. I mean, that's what you want, right? He's your best reliever. Go get him to get the final out. It didn't work out. Unfortunately, I think Ausmus has built up so much. He's burned all his currency with me. So my initial reaction to it is, you dope.
Well, he's burned all of his currency kind of with the fan base, too. You know,
we saw that.
Just booing him, going off the field. I thought it was kind of funny today that they cheered Ausmus heavily when he went out to pull Alfredo Simon. So well done to the Comerica fans today for that. That was hilarious.
And as I said on Twitter, that's what we've come to. 2015 Tigers, your manager that you want fired and gone, he gets the most applause and cheers when he's out there to pull his starter who can't get you through, you know, five. That, awesome. Just awesome. That's where we're at. And I think that's going to wrap it up for our high and tight segment. I'm actually a little disappointed. I thought we were going to have a lot more heated words on this subject, but I guess it, like everything we do in this sort of radio podcast realm, everything is kind of overhyped. So sorry, that was.
I'm just disappointed about my fantasy team. That's what that is.
We will have plenty of time to talk about that in the final segment. When we come back from the break, we'll go into the mob scene at home, take the listener questions, and this is the one guy that we're actually excited to see leaving in 2016. We'll talk about that next.
Swing the fly ball left field. Deep going back. Cabrera looking up. And it's gone. A home run. James McCann with the walk-off winner. Number 3. Rounding third. Exchanges the low 10 with Dave Clark. And into the mob scene.
Indeed we are into the mob scene at home, the part of the show where we take listener questions. And I gotta say, Rob, I have to tip my cap to our listeners, this is what you said in our seventh episode, and I believe that's right, if my counting is correct. We've gone seven episodes with this feature, with this segment, and our fans, our listeners, are still coming up with good questions. I mean, that's pretty impressive given the on-field content that you have to work with, and that's admirable.
It is, especially with, you know, just how bad this team has been. You know, we're getting good, diverse questions, too. It's not like all the same ones every time. People aren't just asking, when are we going to sign you in a Cespedes?
And now that you've said that, question number one comes from Christine K. at Akio_7. And the question is, re-sign Cespedes, yay or nay?
Well, the reason that we kind of threw this one in here is that earlier this week, Yoenis Cespedes told reporters that he wants a six-year contract in free agency. You know, I'm not surprised that Cespedes is asking for the moon in his contract. He's, for one thing, he's represented by Roc Nation, which is Jay-Z's sports agency company. So he's going to ask for a lot of money. I know that Robinson Cano was Jay-Z's big client before when he signed that 10-year, $240 million contract with the Mariners. And given just how ridiculous MLB free agent contracts are, I wouldn't be surprised to see him get a six-year deal. I just really hope that we're not the ones to give that to him.
Totally agree. Totally agree with that. And the issue of the Cespedes contract, just it sort of keeps evolving. You know, and last week we were talking about the fact that he dropped the whatever that clause was that kind of forced the release clause that forced the Mets to release him. And so now this new wrinkle that he wants kind of a long-term contract. Like I said, not too surprised that he's going after it, but yeah, man, he's having a good second half. He had a pretty decent first half, but he's really exploded, you know, with what he's doing with the New York Mets right now. But I just don't see that as, you know, he's due for some regression. The guy is a career, you know, 270 hitter, career 805 OPS. You know, it's respectable, but essentially he's Torrey Hunter, only a lot better with the defense. Of course, you could argue Hunter used to be a ton better with the defense too. But that's what you're ultimately looking at, I think. And I'm not sure that that's worth a 6-7 year contract and 200 and who knows what million dollars. So I'm with you kind of in saying I'm okay with the Tigers not offering that kind of a contract. And if that's what it takes to get him, I will drop my campaign to get Cespedes back as much as I'd like to see him back. Jacob Powers at My Name Is Jake on Twitter says potential offseason targets: buy low on Matt Latos, actually address the bullpen, extension for JD. Where do we go?
Well, I guess let's tackle that third one first. I would really like to see the Tigers try to offer JD Martinez some sort of short-term contract extension. He's under club control for two more years right now under his current deal, and he goes through arbitration next winter, so he's going to get pretty significant raise based on his production this year. But at the same time, it would be nice if they could lock him up for a few more years. He's going to be pushing, I think, about 30 years old, meaning kind of that 29 to 30 range once he hits free agency. So it would be nice to see them get him kind of a short-term extension, maybe get him for two or three more years beyond that. They would need to overpay a little bit, but based on his production this year, I don't think that that's too big of a deal. Because he's going to get kind of a decent raise in arbitration, but I think that if they give him a little bit more than that, they may be able to lock him up.
Would you be in favor of them going for a long-term lockup at this point and saying, give him that six-year contract that Cespedes wants?
Well, I think that that's kind of what I'm speaking of with that, is that, you know, I don't think that they need to give him 6 years beyond what he's already due. Mm-hmm. I think that if you make it more like a four-year extension, I see. So that it gets, you know, includes those 2 years, so you're looking at about six total. I would take that. Yeah, I just don't want them to see him get like, you know, a 6 year extension on top of his 2 years that he's already under club control, and then he's hot on the hook through 2022 or whatever it is, and he will be, you know, 35, 36 years old at that time.
Yeah, and it would make sense, I think, to get that extension done now rather than let him play out the string and get into free agency when, if he's going to keep producing the way he has this year and even last year, you know, if he gets to free agency, it's going to be really expensive to try and lock him up beyond that. So I would, yeah, absolutely be in favor of doing the extension. As far as Matt Latos, if I'm not mistaken, I get my teams and names kind of screwed up sometimes. Is he the one that the Dodgers picked up and then just recently DFA'd, or was that leak?
That's correct. Matt Latos was the one that, he started the year in Miami after being traded from the Reds last offseason, then went to the Dodgers, pitched in six games there, and then was unceremoniously DFA'd earlier this week. Mike Leake, on the other hand, stayed with the Reds through most of the year and then was traded to the Giants at the deadline. You know, I was actually hoping that Matt Latos would be the guy that we would have gotten, either him or Leake, for the Alfredo Simon trade. That would have been a lot better return, although Latos' production this year really hasn't been that great. I don't know if Latos is a guy that I would want to, that I would want to sign as a buy low candidate. He's had kind of some worrying trends. You know, he had a pretty kind of iffy strikeout to walk ratio last year. His strikeout rate has kind of been down over the last couple years, so that's not a good sign. You know, he's got kind of this whole personality thing that he really likes to burn bridges once he leaves a place. So I'm not a huge fan of that either. So I you know, I wouldn't be totally beat up if they signed him, but I think they can do better elsewhere.
Yeah, I would have to agree, and I've kind of advocated for guys like Doug Fister, you know, as a potential buy low person, and that doesn't have to be him specifically, but like you said, I think there are better options. Even though I know I mentioned Matt Latos' name multiple times over the past couple months as someone that might make a good, you know, average level starter that would be better than, say, Shane Green or what Shane Green was putting forward in 2015. But it's kind of funny that kind of went down the way it did with Matt Latos. I don't remember ever seeing that scenario where a team like the Dodgers goes out at the deadline and picks up a pitcher. You know, they trade to get this guy, right? You know, and then within, you know, however many weeks or months, he's DFA'd. Have you ever seen that?
No, and I think it was actually after the deadline, too. I think this was an August move that the Dodgers made to get him.
You're right.
And then they dumped him right after that. You know, it's interesting that they really wanted that 40-man roster spot instead of just kind of letting him sit at the end of the bench for the rest of the year. But, hey, you know, they're dumping money left and right. So the Dodgers are just kind of throwing it in the wind at this point.
Yeah, well, if ever there was a true lost the trade hashtag candidate, that would have to be it. When you trade off for a guy and then DFA him before this half season is even done, that's incredible. So, yeah.
Well, hold on. There is one guy that comes to mind recently, and that is Steve Lombardozzi, who was traded for Alex Gonzalez, and then that guy played, 12 games for the Tigers? And
I thought we talked about not discussing tough subjects like that anymore. But
we're not going to have much of a podcast if we're not discussing tough subjects in Tigers land.
That's absolutely true. And this is why I think after this week, or once the offseason hits, we're going to have to just talk about other teams for a while until Tigers get their business straightened out. But we'll make it happen. We'll keep bringing the content. We'll find some way to fill this time and hopefully entertain the listeners along the way. So, yeah, my overarching answer to that question, my name is Jake Powers. I think we just said we could get better pitchers than Matt Latos. Definitely should probably try to extend JD. And as far as actually addressing the bullpen, yeah, absolutely. Got to do it. Absolutely got to do it. That's been the problem for a long, long time. Can't imagine that Al Avila would take the team into 2016 without doing something about that mess of a bullpen. So look forward to that. Cameron Kaiser, that's a familiar name. I think he writes for us, doesn't he?
From time to time.
Okay. At T-Town Tiger. Hi, Cameron. What's up? Says, what is to be expected out of Aníbal Sánchez going forward, and where does that leave the Tigers' 2016 rotation? Well, we kind of did quite a number on that earlier in the show, didn't we?
We did. You know, with the 2016 rotation, I think you still have to kind of count on Sánchez as part of a member of that, especially how he looks going into November, December. I imagine the Tigers will get kind of some reports from, you know, doctors and whatnot on exactly what to expect. So I think they'll probably have some more information going into the winter meetings and whatnot when they start negotiating with other teams and with free agents. You know, as far as what to expect with him going forward, I think he still has another year on his contract after 2016. I think he's a free agent after 2017. So, you know, if you can get even just, you know, maybe a few more wins out of him in those next two seasons, and I'm talking wins above replacement wins. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can get a couple more of that, you know, it still has been a pretty good deal for the Tigers as far as that contract goes. Obviously, you'd like him to return to form and really kind of be a stalwart in the rotation, but But even if you can get a little bit out of him, if he's effective in those times where he's actually healthy, I think that's still something you gotta take if you're the Tigers.
Yep, absolutely agreed. And I think we said that there's certainly a question mark there. There's the question of, can he stay healthy, or is he a fragile little bunny that's going to break before the season's over? And so you got to kind of prepare for that. I think the Tigers do have some viable options that can, pitchers that can do spot starts and, you know, make it be kind of okay, even in a year that they're trying to contend and go pedal to the metal and get the World Series again. I would definitely plan on getting a number two starter, though, to pair up with Justin Verlander. I don't think you make Aníbal Sánchez that guy. Got to plan for the worst case scenario. So, Meg Rowley, our friend from Lookout Landing, at Meg Growler, me Growler, Meg Growler on Twitter, says, does it bother you that Tom Dubby, that's our own Thomas Bunting, does it bother you that Tom is now Team Seager? Oh no, Meg.
It is, Kyle Seager is kind of a likable player. One of the things I've noticed from him in watching a few Mariners games is that he never makes like a normal face. Every time the camera's on him, he's making like the most awkward face possible. He might be the least photogenic person I've ever seen. But I think the reason that Tom had kind of talked about this with her, they're friends from, I think, grad school or something like that, is that Kyle Seager and Jared Weaver got into kind of a dust-up earlier this week. I believe that, Seager was trying to call time or, step out of the box or something like that, and Weaver was either trying to quick pitch him or almost quick pitch him or something like that. And, Seager didn't appreciate that and said, I'm effing ready or something like that. There were four-letter words exchanged, and then Weaver hit him with a pitch and was ejected.
It was really cool. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I know we're not supposed to cheer for violence and, that kind of thing, but it was really cool the way they kind of got into it. And Seager definitely had some sass in him on that one, the way he stepped back into the box, demonstratively stuck his hand up for timeout and then, said, yeah, I'm effing ready. Four-letter words all over the place, like fork and sock and some things like that. As Vin Scully might say, it appears he wants to invite Jared Weaver out to Fuddruckers. It was really cool. And you know what? I'm not bothered that Tom is Team Seager. That's fine with me. It doesn't matter one way or the other. As long as you are on Team Screw Jared Weaver, I'm cool with it. That is what team I am on.
I think his own teammates are on Team Screw Jared Weaver. There was a video of him earlier this season. He did like a post-game interview or something like that. And I think one of his teammates like threw a water bottle at him or something, and he just gave him like the look of death. It was bad.
I believe it. Jared Weaver's a punk, but at least he doesn't play for our team. So, all right, Southside Sox at Southside Sox. Man, we are getting all kinds of love from the Brotherhood at SB Nation this week. Southside Sox says, which AL Central bench player do you most want to punt into the sun because they kill your team for no reason?
Well, full disclosure, this was actually my question to them for their podcast, and they answered it on their podcast and then kind of threw it back at all the other team sites and wanted to know which terrible player just kills them for no reason. The one that they mentioned was Ryan Rayburn, actually, which I thought was funny. Apparently, Rayburn just torches the White Sox every time he plays against them. Righties, lefties, no matter what it is, he apparently is just a huge thorn in their side. And it's tough for me to think of a current player that would. I know that one guy that came to mind was Eduardo Escobar of the Twins. Over the last couple of years, he, just kind of hit the cover off the ball against them. I believe he hit 500 against the Tigers last season.
Ouch.
Another guy is Bruce Chen, who everyone kind of thought was a quote-unquote Tigers killer.
Yeah, but he wasn't, was he?
Not really. There's not really that clear-cut number one like the White Sox guys had.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a really hard question. It sounds like the kind of that question that you would ask, because that's just really difficult to answer. I'm going to go with the guy's name is it Preston Tucker? I think is who I'm thinking of. Played for the Astros and came out and pinch hit against the Tigers twice this year and hit home runs both times or something. I'm not sure if he even qualifies as a bench player necessarily, but I know he was pinch hitting in both of those occasions. So, yeah, a recent memory is the most painful, so that's who I'm going to go with. It was Preston Tucker, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And then we've got a question here from some joker named Rob, who may or may not be you. So which Tigers player are you most excited to see leave this off season? And I almost can't answer this question fast enough. Go ahead, quick.
No, I asked the question. You get to answer first.
Gorzolani. Have I said? Gorzolani is the player I am most excited to see leave this off season.
See, and I'm going with Alfredo Simon. It's not even a question for me. His start today was absolutely brutal to watch. He's terrible. He got tattooed during the first inning. There was one point where I was watching the game, and I actually tweeted this from the Bless You Boys account. It's like, why am I still watching this game? It was just that bad. And, you know, anytime a guy gets on base, he is so slow. It's awful. And I cannot wait for all this to be over.
You put a question out there on Twitter, like, why am I still watching this game? I mean, did you get pallet loads of snark in response to that?
No, I actually got a lot of retweets.
Well, that's better than snark, I guess. People, misery loves company. And we got a whole lot of company to love a whole lot of misery this year. Fun, fun, fun. Nick Stellini at Stellini Tweets asks again. This is like the third or fourth time I think he submitted this question, so I think we kind of have to answer it. The question is Nick Castellanos a sandwich?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily consider Nick Castellanos a hot dog, so he may be a sandwich.
That is a better answer than anything I'm going to come up with. So, you're right. He's Wait a minute. Are you insinuating that a hot dog is a sandwich?
No, I said a hot dog is not a sandwich.
Are you insinuating that a hot dog is not a sandwich?
He said it is not a sandwich.
But you're suggesting that a hot dog is not a sandwich.
Yes. No.
All right, we're fighting again then, I guess. Is a pizza a sandwich?
No.
Is a sandwich a sandwich?
Maybe.
See? The great philosophers of the past pondered many, many things, and I've scoured their writings and seen nothing dealing with the existential presence, all that good stuff of what is a sandwich. Oh, man, we need to pull this thing together quickly because it's getting weird again. So that's going to wrap it up for our End of the Mob Scene at Home segment. When we get back, we will wrap this show up with a seventh inning kvetch. How's this for a teaser? Get rich quick. Get rich quick. So you can start paying for content. What? What's that mean? I guess we'll talk about that when we get back from the break.
Three now. Here's the 2-2. Oh, boy. Curveball grabbed the outside corner. Victor not happy. Pitch that he felt went around the plate. You rarely see Victor complain. Brad Ausmus better get out there quickly. Oh, and Victor got tossed.
And one final segment to go before we wrap up this, our seventh episode of The Voice of the Turtle. Here we are in the seventh inning kvetch. Time to sound off, talk about all sorts of fun things that may or may not be baseball related or sandwich related, however you want to go. Let's talk a little bit about this recent hobby of yours, Rob, making money at fantasy baseball. And this is going to be a two-parter because after we talk about the whole fantasy sports things and the strategies and, you know, what you get out of it and that sort of thing, I want to talk a little bit about paying for content on good baseball sites like Baseball Reference. So let's start with fantasy baseball. You just started to get into this. It sounds like you had some money in a FanDuel account. Tell me about it.
Well, I did. Full disclosure, SB Nation and FanDuel have partnered up, and I have been given some money over the last couple of years to just kind of play around with it. That's why that all of our game previews are sponsored by FanDuel or whatnot, is that I do get a little bit of money towards that. Not a ton, but a little bit. And it is just kind of fun to poke around with it and see what I can do as far as, you know, picking a lineup of players and seeing how well they do. This is great timing because last night I actually won, you know, a decent amount of money, and you know, I say that it's about $20 or so, playing with it. It's kind of more just a hobby for me. I don't necessarily know that I would have ever put my own money into the account, but you know, it's there, and so I might as well just kind of play around with it, and I have a good time with it.
Yeah, it's something that I had heard about for quite a while, I think, but never really got into it until this year. I think I heard a radio promo, and they were offering something like $25 if you put 25 in, and I thought, well, that sounds like a really good deal just to see what daily fantasy sports is all about. So I got a FanDuel account as well, and started to mess around with it. It was really addictive at first and just super easy user interface. You know, you just go boom, 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 but just set my line up. And you always have that wonderful feeling of hope. You know, I said today on Twitter, the best part of a sports filled day is before things actually start playing, because you just got so much hope and anticipation, and you would put these lineups out there. And I've been kind of doing a little bit of reading. I don't know if you've like got into it at all, you know, and I actually paid for a subscription to, what's that site called? Roto World, I think, where they will actually generate optimal lineups for you. And you can kind of pick and choose and say, you know, I want to lock down this guy or that guy. And then you fill out the rest of the lineup for me. It gets very addictive, and it's also very, very hard to win any kind of money at it. Like the first week that I played it, I think I won like $70 2 days in a row, and then have not like won anything since. And we're talking like this was back in like, I don't know, May. So here we are in September and I'm down to like $3 left out of that. So it was just enough at first to keep me going. But yeah, it goes quickly. And it's to me, Rob, it's like, it's so hard to, I don't know, like, it's not just a matter of the wild randomness of two teams playing each other and trying to pick which one's going to win. That's hard enough. You have to pick from, what is it, I don't know, probably like 270 or so active players playing in any given, you know, 9-player lineup and 16 games going on. And you have to pick the 9 right players that are actually going to perform for you that day. I mean, how are you having any success in this? How did you win money yesterday?
Blind luck, maybe, I don't know. You know, part of it really is just kind of, I enjoy it because I like to, you know, find the players myself. You know, I've read some things about these whole computer generated lineups, optimal lineups and things like that. And I think that kind of, it's not necessarily why I'm doing it. I don't necessarily want to get into the argument of whether that's right or wrong or anything like that. You know, you hear these things about, you know, certain like daily fantasy sharks or whatever they are winning boatloads of money because of, you know, computer generated programs that they've created. I do it just to kind of see how I do as far as like picking the right lineup, you know, picking guys based on matchups and, you know, previous history against pitchers, things like that.
Yeah, you can write programs for it. And I've done kind of messed around with that. That's kind of the industry that I'm in. So I have some capability of loading up databases and, you know, feeding stats and trying to generate those kind of things. But like I said, that's a great answer, by the way. Pure dumb luck, whatever you said. Write a book. I dare you to write a book, How to Win at Fantasy Sports. Pure dumb luck. It would be the most honest daily fantasy sports book you'll ever buy, and it'll be a bestseller.
I need someone to do illustrations. I can make a children's book.
Don't you know how to work MS Paint?
A little bit.
Okay, well, that's all you need. It's a children's book. Just
all right.
Scratch some lines out. This could be like a huge bestseller now that I think about it. I'm not even kidding. Oh my goodness, that would be fun. But yeah, you can put so much, you know, effort into this. You can run all the stats you want, play the matchups you want, and you could have on paper, just a killer lineup. And I've done this multiple times where I'd have like, you know, Chris Sale as my starting pitcher, and I've gotten Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera in the same lineup. You still have to be lucky enough to have that be the day that those guys perform. And it almost seems like maybe as you play out the string this season, you could try this. Try setting the same lineup and just keeping it for a week. Because at some point, these guys are going to have to click. You know, it's just a matter of getting them all to click all at once and on the same day.
It could work. I mean, you'd have to change a pitcher every day. But, you know, in theory, it would be kind of interesting to see. And I've seen some, some people offer that advice. Like, you know, if you pick up Miguel Cabrera or Paul Goldschmidt or whoever for a game, you know, keep them in the same lineup for a week and build around that. You know, I kind of just like to, you know, go by the seat of my pants, I guess, with it. I'm definitely not as serious into it as you are, it seems. So, you know, I'm kind of just messing around with it.
Oh, sure. Paint me as the nerd. That's cool. It's just, yeah, I don't mess around like you do. I mean, you creep, you weirdo. Yeah. I don't mess around with it as much anymore, I'll tell you that. Losing and losing and losing and losing will tend to kind of suck the fun out of anything you're doing, as Tigers fans in 2015 are well familiar with that feeling. Let's shift the topics, though, because this kind of ties in. The whole reason why I ended up playing at DraftKings, and the show is not sponsored by DraftKings, was because Baseball Reference tied in with them and offered a free, quote-unquote, free subscription to the Baseball Reference Play Index if you deposited $25 at DraftKings. And I thought, that's perfect. I I had never used the Play Index before. I wasn't really sure how to use it. Didn't feel like dropping whatever it is, $40 for the subscription on a tool that I would spend most of the year learning how to use. But I thought, hey, for $25 in a DraftKings account that I then have a chance of winning that money back in fantasy sports, yeah, you know, go for it. So I started playing around with the baseball reference, you know, Play Index this year. It's been really awesome. Highly recommended, especially if you do, you know, anything to do with fantasy sports and, you know, just the heavier stats stuff. You want to be able to use that Play Index and generate some really cool stats. They were having a bit of a conversation, though, on Twitter this week. Some of the guys from Baseball Reference and around baseballreference.com were talking about the fact that, you know, really they don't get enough money through subscriptions on the site to support the site, to pay their developers, you know, to pay for site space and server space and all that kind of stuff. And so they run advertising. You know, if you're not going to pay for a Play Index subscription, then you got ads on the site. And the problem is that, of course, so many browsers now come with plugins where you can shut off ads. You've got ad blocking, you know, going on. Kind of turned into a little bit of a hot topic for debate. You know, in terms of if you're going to use a site like that and that's how they're making a majority of the revenue, should you just go ahead and whitelist that site and, you know, turn off the ad blockers? But then that raises the question kind of more broadly speaking, you know, and our website does ads as well, and you can block those or not block them. But I don't know, Rob, like it's tough as a user. I want the content. I don't want to subscribe for it. I also don't want your annoying ads popping up, so I run the ad blocker. And you know, it's kind of a weird, you know, like, should you do that? Should you go ahead and let the ads run so these sites get the money? Or, you know, how do you feel about that?
I kind of go a little bit both ways with it. I do run the ad blocker sometimes, especially on some websites that, you know, it really tends to bog down. I don't run it on our website, and that's not to say that we get any of the ad revenue. We don't get anything as far as ads go on Bless You Boys. I do it more just to kind of see what is popping up on the site, and if there's anything we need to kind of keep clear. But at the same time, I think that there is kind of a time and place for, you know, paying for content, things like that. You know, you would like for everything to be free, but at the same time, you know, you pay for music and you pay for movies and things like that. Why shouldn't you have to also pay for great content on the web? There are a couple different sites I've subscribed to. I've also paid for the Play Index at Baseball Reference. There are a couple other guys, Paul Sporer, a guy who is a Tigers fan and writes for like every baseball website on the internet. I don't know how he does it. You know, he puts out a starting pitcher guide every year, and I pay for that as well. So there are a few, and especially I'm more inclined to do it if it kind of goes directly to that person or those people. When I'm paying for content, as opposed to like a bigger site overall. Right. But there are, you know, certain things like ESPN Insider. I wouldn't necessarily want to pay for that, that type of thing, even though I do find some of that content valuable, especially the stuff that Keith Law puts out. So I'm more inclined to do it if it's kind of towards a specific person and their revenue specifically.
Yeah, it's kind of a hard situation, I think, because, you know, I kind of chimed in the conversation on Twitter and said, you know, I don't ad block because I'm a jerk, you know, because, oh, I just want free content. I don't want to do it. I do it because there's a lot of very invasive, intrusive ads, and I don't know what's coming out of this, you know, on a site-by-site basis. I don't know. And I'm talking beyond just baseball sites. Anywhere you go on the web, you know, you have to deal with pop-ups, and you have to deal with auto-starting videos, which are the devil. Stop putting auto-start videos. Or if you're going to do that, at least start them out muted, because, you know, I go to a site and, like, work, you know, or whatever, and suddenly it's, I'm like, oh, hey, guess who's not, you know. It's obnoxious. It's funny you mention our site. I block ads on our site, too. And the reason is a lot of them are use the technology Flash-based, you know, for the ads. It crashes my browser all the time, constantly, if I don't run the ad blocker. So it's tough. It's really tough. I would like to let the ads run, especially for a site like Baseball Reference, which I think is incredibly valuable and incredibly well-run. I don't want to see that site go away. And if you're listening to this podcast, I would absolutely advocate. I've never had a problem with ads on their site. They're one of the safe ones. I whitelist them, absolutely. Recommend that you do the same. But, you know, yeah, sites in general, it's a case-by-case basis. I block ads on MLB because they take over everything. They crash my browser. They break things, and they have auto-start videos that are loud and blaring. And it's like, no, you gotta get better at doing the ad thing if you want people to let it run. You know, it's a sad reality. It's hard because I certainly don't want to cheat anybody out of, you know, the money that they should be getting for the work that they're doing, you know. So anyway, on that note, we have just about drained the bank account for this episode of the podcast, and we do not want any overdraft charges. So, Rob, any final thoughts before we cash out our chips?
Nope, I'm just kind of excited for the upcoming playoff race. Not necessarily Tigers, but the other teams going down the stretch. It's been fun to watch. The Rangers and Astros played a pretty good series last week, even though the Rangers won all four games. It was really kind of exciting to see that atmosphere. And so I'm looking forward to a little bit more of that going down the last couple of weeks of the season.
I was telling my son about this the other day, just kind of catching up on where things are at with the playoff race. I was surprised because I don't think I ever in a million years thought that we'd be talking about the New York Mets instead of the Nationals, or the Texas Rangers instead of the Houston Astros. Not with the way the Rangers started out the season. You know, it's funny. You saw me put this on Twitter, but I looked back at my preseason predictions, and I had the Chicago White Sox and the Washington Nationals going to the World Series, with the Nationals winning. That was my preseason prediction. I had Chris Sale pegged for the Cy Young Award, too. So maybe next year, don't ask me to make a prediction.
I mean, not many of us did much better.
I know. It's just so funny.
I had the Mariners in the World Series.
You did?
I had the Mariners, yeah.
Based on what?
A lot of people did. You know, they had a pretty good rotation. That lineup was getting better. You know, Nelson Cruz came out and did what he was supposed to. It was just that no one else did.
Listen to me, like, why did you do that? Like my pick was any better. My God, the White Sox. The White Sox! I had the White Sox in the World Series. Whatever I was smoking back in January, I want to find it again, because that was apparently some really good shit. Oh, boy. All right, well, our last episode's numbers and ratings were far and away the best they've been in probably over a year, so my sincere thanks to you listeners for tuning in and spending your time with us. This is so much more enjoyable for us when we know we've actually got an audience, because honestly, hurling podcasts into the loneliness of the void is just one step away from buying Comic-Con tickets. So thanks for listening to this episode of the Voice of the Turtle podcast. If you want to keep the discussion going, leave your comments at the website. They're on the podcast post at www.blessyouboys.com. You can hit us up on Twitter at HookslideBYB or BYBRob on Twitter, or just send us an email at BYBTigers@gmail.com. And until next time, this is Hookslide on behalf of Rob Rojacki and the Angry Boo Birds everywhere, saying we'll see you at the after party on the next Voice of the Turtle.